Tonight we're continuing our series in the book of Esther. So last time we had chapter 1, so this night we're going to start with chapter 2. So let's read Esther chapter 2 together. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Hegai the king's eunuch, custodian of the women. And let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This thing pleased the king, and he did so. In Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was, when the king's command and decree was heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan's citadel, under the custody of Hegai, that Esther was also taken to the king's palace, into the care of Hegai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favour. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her, besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Each young woman's turn came to go in to King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months' preparation according to the regulations for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go in to the king again, unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Now, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Hegai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favour in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace, in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favour in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants. And he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces, and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. When the virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. But Esther obeyed the commands of Mordecai, as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informs the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. That's Esther chapter 2. Now, what do we make of all of that? You remember last time we heard about Queen Vashti, and we heard that she displeased the king at a banquet, and she was sent away, or she was deposed from being the queen. It seems there's quite a long gap between chapter 1 and chapter 2. Now, we're not sure exactly how long, but it could be up to 5 or 6 years, maybe. In chapter 2, we have two apparently unconnected events. We have the search for the replacement of the queen, and then in verses 19 to 23, we have Mordecai introduced. So let's look at them in turn. First, verses 1 to 18, where we learn how Esther rose to become the queen of Persia. When we first meet Esther, in verse 7 of the chapter, we find Esther being raised by her cousin Mordecai following the death of her parents. And we're told two specific things about Esther, both of which are going to be significant for what follows, well, not necessarily for this chapter. We have a problem dealing with this book in chapters. So much of it is interconnected. So you've got to remember things now, which you're going to learn much later on. So it's going to test your memory of it if you're doing one-on-one. But let's see how we go. We're told here that Esther had the Jewish name Hadassah, meaning myrtle. But throughout this book, she's known by the Persian name Esther, which means star. And we're also told that Esther was lovely, beautiful, attractive. Now, you'll remember the events of chapter 1, where Queen Vashti was removed, and the seven princes of Persia told the king to write a decree, an edict, forbidding her to come into the king's presence. Now, it could be that we have the famous Greek War of 480, which fits into the period between chapter 1 and chapter 2. Certainly, the king is absent from the country for some time, it seems. But something seems to have triggered the memory of Vashti in his mind. Perhaps he's returned to the country. Perhaps he's feeling lonely without a queen around. We don't know. But he's in need of something to brighten his mood, and his thoughts turn to Vashti. Now, his advisers suggest a solution. There's no Vashti around, so what do? We find another queen. And they suggest all the beautiful young virgins are brought for the king to select one. Now, this idea pleases the king quite a lot. And we get something of a national beauty contest in verses 1 to 16. Now, we don't make much of beauty contests in this country much these days, though they're still popular in some countries, where they're taken very seriously. But generally, in the contests we have today, the women are judged on many factors. But here it seems beauty alone was the primary focus, at least at the beginning. Esther is drawn into this contest. Now, it seems like that it is not a voluntary thing. It said the women are taken. They weren't volunteering to become the king's wife. So Esther is taken along with other potentially suitable girls from across the kingdom, gathered by the local officials, and brought into the palace under the care of Hegai to await her turn with the king. Now, we're told that Esther quickly found favour with Hegai and gets placed in the best position, and she gets attendants to take care of her. Now, we're not told why Esther received favour, but it seems there's more going on than simply her beauty, for after all, she's surrounded by lots of other very beautiful women. Something attracts Hegai to her. But when I think of this story, I'm reminded of a different biblical account. Someone else who's removed from their family to a foreign land and ends up somewhere they can't get out of, guarded through no fault of their own, and both gain favour with the person looking after them. Yes, we have Joseph to think of, don't we? And Esther and Joseph have another similarity, don't they? You know, both will be used to bring about a great deliverance for their people. That's something else, it doesn't come out in this chapter, but something else to bear in mind as we go through the book. Now, we're not told much about how this beauty contest was organised, and we don't know much about how Esther felt about it, whether she was pleased with the prospect of marrying the king or not. In all the events here, she seems rather passive. What we are told is that Esther dealt wisely in every action throughout this account. She won the favour of Hegai, the person in whose charge she was, and as verse 15 reminds us, she found the favour in all the people she came into contact with. So although she had no choice in the events, she was there through no reason that she wanted to be there, but she had 12 months to look forward to in this place. And she's put through this rather extensive beauty regime that we're not told that much about. I mean, 12 months does seem quite excessive, doesn't it? It must involve much more than simply cleaning the body. So it's probably about as much about the pomp and the ceremony and the idea of spending this time preparing rather than actually cleansing themselves. But of course there's probably a practical reason here. And we're told all these young women were virgins, and 12 months certainly makes sure of that, doesn't it? There's no prospect here of the royal line being contaminated. But, for whatever reason, when it was her time to visit the king, Esther again, she takes the advice of Hegai, and that's a sensible thing to do. Hegai knows what's been going on, he knows what these other women have been taking in to see the king. He knows how they got on. So he knows what's likely to make a favourable impression. So when she follows his advice, she's being wise. And it seems to be successful, doesn't it? We're told that Esther made a favourable impression on the king or any of the other women. Verse 17, he loves her more than any of the other women. And Esther becomes the queen in the place of Vashti. Now, we're not told what life was like for Esther after she became queen, but something else that's important. Verse 20, we are told Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai just when she's brought up by him. So she may be marrying the king, but she seems to be taking her orders from somewhere else. So, she's known by her Persian name throughout this. Now, why do we think that Mordecai gave her this command? We're not told the reason, but there are things we can surmise, perhaps. Maybe there was an anti-Jewish feeling in the country as a result of the past conflicts. Well, we know the Jews went into this country as captives, didn't they? I mean, certainly a few chapters later on, there seems to be sufficient anti-Jewish feeling that the people are happy to turn on them when there's something to be gained from the action. Maybe Mordecai feared the king would reject her if she revealed her heritage. After all, she was living in the capital city. It's perhaps logical the king would think of her that she's Persian. We don't know, but it is important for what follows. But again, we can't leave this portrait of Esther without remarking on her character. She's acted wisely, and she still stands out. She's surrounded by all these other stunning women. The only thing that would make her stand out is her character. But after all, she's in a country, but she doesn't want to be in this situation. She's an exile from her country to start with. She's been taken into this palace when it wasn't her choice to be there. She probably doesn't even like the king. It would be easy for her to resent her situation, wouldn't it? She could have been sullen and uncooperative. But she doesn't behave in that way. She is, in fact, a model of godly behaviour throughout. She draws people to her at every stage. But let's leave Esther for a moment. Let's move on to look at Mordecai. Now, we're told that he is a cousin of Esther, and we're given his lineage. And we're told that Mordecai was a Benjamite. Now, that again doesn't matter at this stage, but it's going to matter later on. In chapter 3, we've introduced Haman the Agagite. And he doesn't like Benjamites very much. But that's someone else's story, so I'm going to leave that one. So, let's move on to verse 2, chapter 21. What's Mordecai doing while Esther is sitting in the palace? Well, Mordecai is pacing backwards and forwards, trying to learn about Esther. And then Mordecai sits within the king's gate. Now, that's a change. First of all, we're told he's pacing around learning about Esther. But then he's sitting in the king's gate. Why is he doing that? Well, we don't know. But, again, we can surmise. Does he want to sit there just because he's close to Esther? Or has he got a role there? Is he doing something specific? Certainly there seems to be communication between Esther and Mordecai, as we find out later on. Did Esther perhaps arrange for a job for him? Sitting in the gate suggests some authority, doesn't it? Suggests perhaps he's acting as a judge, or somewhere that you sit in somewhere as a court official. After all, the gate is where the justice is given. It's where people come to present their case. Again, we don't know, but we can surmise. It, after all, is not unusual for the Jewish people to hold positions of authority. Well, again, we talked of Joseph, but we could also talk more specifically in this case of Daniel and his friends. Before Persia, we had Babylon. And Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael all held all important roles in Babylonian administration. We read about that in Daniel chapter 2. And Daniel, of course, survived from Babylon into the new Persian administration. But, however it was, Mordecai came to learn of a plot. Did he learn about it in his role as a judge, or while he's sitting in the king's gate listening to what other people are saying? We don't know, but he learned about this plot by the king's gatekeepers, Bigthan and Teresh. And what did he do? He reported the matter to Esther, who reported the matter to the king. Now, again, why did they do that? Well, it seems they respected the authority of the king. These are Jews who have no particular love of the Persian authorities. They were taken into exile, away from their own country, and yet we find them working for the good of the Persian king. Their families were brought to Persia against their will, and even now Mordecai and Esther have been separated, presumably against Esther's will. Yet we don't find them being resentful. We find them respecting the authority of the king, seeking his good. Now, why was that? Something to think about, but I'll get to that in a moment. But what was the result of their actions? Well, a plot was discovered, and these two people were executed. How were they executed? Well, we say it says here they were hung on the gallows. Or literally, it's a tree. Again, what Esther and Mordecai would have known, well, I bet they'd be familiar with things like Deuteronomy 21. It occurs to everyone who's hung on a tree. To them, that may have been perhaps a sign that they did the right thing, that these people were under the curse of God. But, again, this being hung on a tree takes on great significance in New Testament times. But this plot was seen, it was detected, and importantly, it was recorded in the presence of the king. And there the matter was left. Again, until later in the book. So please bear all these things in mind as we work the rest later on. Now, Esther, the person who wrote Esther is like a master storyteller. Every detail links forward in the story, or it seems to link backwards to other events in Jewish history. And that is great, because you have to pay attention all the way through, plus you have to know the Jewish history. On one level, there's not much in this story, or at least in the chapter we're looking at now. It lays the groundwork for what follows. But there is another way to look at all of this preparation work, isn't it? It's very encouraging. Because first of all, of course, we're reminded that we have a God who knows the end from the beginning, who is working his purposes out in history. We could say, for example, that God created the exact circumstances to place Esther where she needed to be. Now, Esther doesn't know this yet, just as we may not know what's happening at the time. Esther didn't know why she caught up in these affairs of state, but in time it would become clear to her, as events will become clear to us, of course. I mean, we know the events of chapter 2 take place over at least a year. Probably longer. It takes a long time to bring all these young ladies to all these different provinces, 127 provinces, so it's going to take quite some time for these events to unfold. And we know the events of chapter 1, the removal of Vashti, took place sometime before all of that. These events have been put in motion, and they're seemingly unconnected with each other. But they're working towards this unseen goal. Think about the events that have unfolded so far in Esther. What can we say? We can talk about the refusal of Vashti to obey the king, the method chosen to replace Vashti, the timing of the contest. As we say, these events took place some time after chapter 1, and they took place at the exact time where Esther was the perfect age to get caught up. I mean, a few years younger, she'd have been far too young. And then we have the choice of the king. The king went out and chose Esther. We have Mordecai discovering the plot, and the plot actually being officially recalled in the chronicles in the presence of the king. Now, any one of those events not happening would have completely derailed the rest of the book. And yet, from the outside, they look entirely random. From our perspective, we can see them building towards a fixed, unchangeable conclusion. But Esther couldn't see any of that. She has no idea what's happening at this point. But again, we could say, why did God choose this particular method to preserve the Jewish people? He could have intervened in a thousand different ways to achieve his purpose. But he chose to use ordinary people. Well, he didn't come down and supernaturally remove Haman from the scene, did he? He chose to have his people in Babylon at that time, and he chose to use Esther. Now, how was Esther in a position to be used then, in that way? Well, we find her settling down, or her family rather, settling down in Babylon, just as had been instructed by Jeremiah. Settling down in the early years of the exile to seek the good of the land. But this brings us a point, doesn't it? By the time we get to Esther, large numbers of Jews already returned to the land. So why was Esther and Mordecai still in Persia? I mean, Jeremiah told the Jews to settle down and live out the exile, but the exile could be over for them. So why are they still there? Babylon was long gone. The Persian Empire is now in charge. So why didn't they return? We don't know, we're not told. We can surmise various things. I mean, it's probably unfair to blame Esther. She would have been too young at this point to have returned by herself. She probably wasn't even born when the exiles returned. But Mordecai may have been old enough. And we don't know why he didn't go back. Maybe he had a job he didn't want to leave. Maybe he had responsibilities in Persia. Maybe he was simply comfortable there and didn't want to return to a prospectively dangerous country where he would just start from the beginning again. After all, you may have been nobility. We don't know why he didn't return, but we know that he stayed there. I mean, they could even have returned after the other exiles. There's nothing stopping them returning by himself. Perhaps they considered the journey too dangerous. Well, we're told that, but here's this, we're told this, for example, all the people whose spirit God had stirred up returned to rebuild the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. And Mordecai didn't. So can we fault them for returning, but not returning, for staying in Persia? The text doesn't pass any judgment on them. What we can say is that God chose to use them where they were, even though they didn't return. Perhaps they were wrong for staying in Persia, but they're not abandoned or rejected by God because they made that decision. Instead, they get to play a central role in preserving the lives of the other Jews living in Persia. And that's encouraging for us too, isn't it? How many times have we missed opportunities to do something when we should have done it, when we should have said this or done that? Perhaps we too could have claimed the timing wasn't right, or that we couldn't afford to take a risk. It's easy to make excuses, isn't it? But making excuses is easy. However, we can see with Esther and Mordecai here, just because we've missed that opportunity doesn't mean there won't be further opportunities. What else can we say then? Well, we can look at Esther too, as indeed as we can look at most of Esther, as an example of the providence of God in action. But we can also ask a slightly different question, can't we? We can ask, why did God choose to do it this way? Why didn't God intervene dramatically? Why did he choose to use ordinary people? Well, we can say that God normally uses secondary causes. He normally uses people like us. And we can quote the 1689 Confession for a moment. Chapter 5, we can say, God, the good creator of all things, in his infinite purpose, per power and wisdom, doth uphold, direct and dispose and govern all creatures and all things, from the greatest even to the least, by his most wise and holy providence, to the end for the which they were created. So they were created to serve his purposes, according to his providence, according to his infallible foreknowledge, and for the free and immutable counsel of his own will, to the praise of his glory, for his wisdom, power, justice, infinite goodness and mercy. And paragraph 2, although in relation to the foreknowledge and decree of God the first cause, all things come to pass immutably and infallibly, so that there is not anything befalls by any chance or without his providence, yet by the same providence he ordereth them to fall out according to the nature of second causes, either necessarily, freely or contingently. So God orders them to fall out by secondary causes. That's us. He doesn't do things directly. He chooses to work through us. He causes to bring about purposes to achieve his will, and that also heals us for his glory. I mean, one of the proof texts the Confession gives for that first paragraph we read is Isaiah 46 verse 10, which reads, God declaring from the end, from the beginning, and from ancient times, things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all for my pleasure. So why does God order these things? Why does he choose to say to use Esther in that way? For his glory. Because his counsel has to stand. And he does it all for his pleasure. So God does these things for his pleasure, for his glory. God sets up his counsel, and his purposes will stand. And he chooses to do it through people like us. Nothing in this world should have the chance. And this really should encourage it, shouldn't it? Because if these things stand because it is God's will, what is God's will for us? What do we know? We can have confidence that all the promises God has given us will stand. When we look around at the world and it looks chaotic, but we know there is a king on the throne of heaven reigning over the nations, and we know that his will prevail. We know what ultimately happens. We know that the nations have been given to Christ for his inheritance. We know that he's calling out people from every nation under heaven. And we need to quote the hymn writer, God is working his purpose out as year succeeds to year. And the time will surely be when the earth will be filled with the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. We know that God has a purpose. We know that he is calling a people. And there is nothing that is going to stop him calling those people out of every nation under heaven. Now, we have no idea how he's going to do that, but we know it is going to happen. And we know that everything that has happened in the world is a part of his plan to achieve that. There is nothing random, there is nothing that happens by chance, but it all happens for the glory of God. God is glorified in everything that happens in this world. And that is what I want us to remember. That is what I want to take away from tonight. So we're going to leave it there and let someone else take on chapter 3 and see how things turn out.